You're listening to the Bird Dog Babe Podcast with my mom, Courtney Bastion.
This episode is presented to you by Purina Pro Plan and Boss Shot Shells.
I don't know how many people I know that say, I wouldn't hunt if it worked for my dog. I have to go out today. I don't really feel like hunting, but my dog wants to go. And it's because it really has become a partnership. I know a lot of people who have companion dogs and household dogs and family dogs, and those dogs are wonderful parts of their lives. But until you are working with a dog in a real partnership, an unspoken understanding of all kinds of stuff, there's nothing in the world that compares to it, in my mind.
I just returned home from a week in Houston with the Purina Pro Plan team. Guess what every single group winner and best in show winner for 5 days straight fed their dogs? Yep, Purina Pro Plan. Why do they feed it? Because Purina and their staff of over 500 veterinarians and scientists test for palatability and digestibility. Dogs love the food and what they're eating they're using. To prove that, ProPlan dogs have stool that is small, dark, and firm. And if you pick up after a lot of dogs like I do, you certainly notice and appreciate a good solid turd. Boss Shot Shells. I've said it before and I'm pushing it even more right now. If you haven't already, get your Boss Shot Shells ordered today. The ammo shortage is no joke and the guys at Boss are working around the clock. Due to the impacts of the global supply shortages, prices will be going up on August 1st. But Boss gave us their word that this is only temporary, and once raw costs drop, so will their prices. Don't get crazy and hoard ammo. Save some for the next guy. Siren, shotguns for women. People have been asking me about the wing shooting camp in Pine City, Minnesota on September 21st and 22nd. If you're not going, you're missing out. Certified shooting instructors Tracy Wright from Dark Horse Shooting in Washington and Kate Onstrom from Virginia Shooting Sports will be specifically focused on instinctive wing shooting techniques. So the Sporting Clays course will be set to common flight patterns. They'll teach you foot positioning and approach versus standing on a platform. You'll be in a group of 4 people total for 4 hours. You'll then have the option to audit the other instructor, attend the information and demo sessions, which includes learning about chokes, ammo, and gauges, how to navigate and use Onyx with Ben Bredingen, hunting rough grouse with Rough Grouse Society, American Woodcock Society's Director of Communications and Marketing, Ashley Peters. You can watch some different dog breeds in the NAVDA dog demos, woodcock hunting with Bailey Peterson, and wild game prep with Simon Teach. Siren, Cesar Guarini, and Fab Arm shotguns will all be available for demo and use throughout the weekend. For more information and to register, go to projectupland.com and click on the events tab. Dakota 283. If you aren't keeping your dog in a kennel that is built for protection and keeping your dog safe, it's time to make that investment. Kennels built to last, easy to put in and take out of your vehicle, doors that lock, and Dakota Guard antimicrobial protection. Get yourself one before hunting season. Your dog deserves it. If you're looking for a chance to win a G3 medium kennel or dine and dash, become a Patreon patron of this podcast by going to patreon.com/thebirddogbabe. Write a review and send me a screenshot and you'll be entered in the drawing, which is taking place on September 1st. If you need a crate before then, be sure to use promo code BIRDDOGBABE for 10% off at checkout. My guest today is Nancy Annisfield. Nancy has been a bird hunter for over 20 years with her German short-haired pointers, and she has hunted in over a dozen states, plus Canada and Argentina. She's a full-time outdoor writer specializing in wing shooting and hunting dogs. Nancy explains the 5 stages of being a bird dog owner as it relates to the 5 stages of being a hunter. She's a wealth of knowledge after 17 years of experience training and testing in NAVDA. All right, let's get after it. Good morning, Nancy. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Courtney.
I'm very excited to have you. I've enjoyed chatting with you over the last, maybe a couple months or so, getting to know you a little bit more. And so I would like you giving a little introduction of yourself, of who you are and what you do in the bird dog industry.
I could certainly do that. But, you know, one thing just occurred to me when you said, yeah, you know, I was talking over the last few months, that in and of itself, that's kind of a little bit of an interesting story. You know, even though our paths had crossed previously, mm-hmm, through Pheasants Forever, other, and a couple of other pathways, but right, I had contacted, to me, this is an interesting story that talks about our community and our, you know, the wing shooting world, yeah, that I'm training with somebody, doing dog training with somebody whose daughter had moved to Montana and was lamenting not having other bird dog women to connect with. And I said, well, let me look around anybody who I may know of or think of through NABDA or Pheasants Forever, and came up with your name, and just like out of nowhere emailing you and saying, hey, there's this young woman who's out there on her own by herself. And, you know, it just kind of speaks for how much we all can relate to each other and how sort of receptive the network is.
Yes, absolutely.
And that also kind of just led to us getting into our own conversations, as you just mentioned, which became so much fun, because once we start talking about hunting and dogs, we kind of take off from there.
And, then we just kind of got lost.
Exactly. Exactly. So I'm very honored to be on the podcast, and I know we've had a lot of fun talking, and I enjoy sharing it with other people. Yes. By way of background, because there's an awful lot of stuffed in there, I have been hunting for 25 years. I was not a hunter growing up. My husband, when I met him, was a deer hunter and a duck hunter. But we went up to a preserve and saw bird dogs working. And I saw a pointing dog and said, I got to do this. And once I saw a pointing dog point, it was like, okay, I want to get one. I had an uncle that we all used to laugh at back in suburban New Jersey, because he had German shorthairs and he hunted on a pheasant preserve. And so I kind of dug up those memories and got my own shorthair and became a hunter. And so in terms of developing myself as a dog person and a hunter, that's kind of how I got into it. Originally, I figured, oh, I just want to handle a dog. I don't want to be a shooter. And then realized, hey, if I'm going to let this dog do what it was bred to do, I better be going out and hunting and shooting for it. So that's kind of where my pathway as a hunter began. And kind of in a parallel course on my own career and work-wise, I have been through a couple of different careers, beginning as a commercial illustrator, then going back to school, being an English professor, putting the writing and the art concepts together, became a freelance outdoor writer and photographer. So for the past 15, 20 years, I have been doing outdoor writing and photography, specializing in hunting dogs and wing shooting, working for a lot of the wonderful publications and wing shooting media. So I was very lucky in having my work world and my play world combined, so I could be doing both at once, both where exactly where I felt my passion. And then if I jump to what to me would be the trifecta, is where I volunteer and where I give back. And obviously training bird dogs hooked me into NAVDA, North American Versatile Hunting Dog Association. But at the same time, as an outdoor editor, I was editing the Upland Almanac magazine for a number of years. I was approached, you know, I did a lot of work with conservation organizations, and then was approached by Pheasants Forever to join their board of directors. So I've been 8 years on the Pheasants Forever board of directors. Nice. And I'll just spin that one more further, just because we're in a happy household here. So my husband, being a hunter and a bird dog man, is the owner of the Ugly Dog Hunting Company. So he, I don't know, a lot of years ago, started a wing shooting gun dog hunting supply company. And at the same time, he became more involved with the Rough Grouse Society and is on the board of the Rough Grouse Society now. So we are very lucky people, combining work, play, and giving back in everything we're passionate about. I think that's my summary.
Yeah. I mean, your whole lives are just surrounded around the dogs and the hunting, which, how incredibly fortunate are you? That's everybody's dream, Nancy.
It really is. And, you know, we don't take it for granted. We're very, you know, very grateful to be able to be doing this, you know, and working hard, but working at things we love. And to that end, we also, I'll just put one more little layer on top. Last year, we formed an LLC that's called Track to Wing. And what we're doing right now is we are Track to Wing grants action track chairs to people who have severe mobility challenges so that they can get back into the field and work with bird dogs. Or if they haven't really trained bird dogs and gone bird hunting or duck hunting, we provide them with the means to get in the field and do things that they couldn't with typical wheelchairs or, you know, other avenues of mobility that limit them. And that has just been an amazing experience too.
That's incredible. Those are extremely durable. Those, what are they called? What is the name of those?
Well, Action is the manufacturer. Okay. And they're called track chairs, or there's also one called a track stander, where literally it can stand you upright. The others are just sitting, but the track stander, you can sit or stand. But they, yeah, it's track. They're track chairs. It's an all terrain vehicle, so it's like a wheelchair on steroids. I was like, a beefed up wheelchair with big treads on it. So it's battery operated. It can go on all kinds of rough terrains. We've had some of our track chair recipients send us pictures where they're pheasant hunting in South Dakota in the snow. And of course, a lot of them take them out fishing. One of the guys on our advisory committee, who we've known for many years, he wasn't a track to wing recipient, but he has a track chair, and he'll go out and shoot a deer, put a rope around it, and drag it home. They're amazing, amazing machines.
They are. I've seen them used in the Wounded Warrior Project in a hunt with one of those, and holy cow, what they can get through and be able to do and get back out in the field and hunt again is just, it makes it truly a blessing. So that's incredible. You guys are involved with that. How can people find out more about that? Do you have a website with information?
No, we don't have a website. We're I'm not going to say partner, because Track to Wing is totally self-funding and self-managing. But when we got started, we went to the executive council at NAVDA and said, could you just help us get the word out? Because we didn't know how to reach out across the country and say, you know, would anybody be interested in applying for one? And so we usually put the word out through NAVDA. And also this year, we asked Pheasants Forever the same. So right now, our applications were open from January till the end of April or end of May. We're done for this year. First year, we had granted eight or nine track chairs. This year, we granted 11, I believe. And so we're done for this year. We'll open up again in January. So it's a matter of, we can be contacted through NAVDA, through Ugly Dog Hunting Company, through me, my own website, or through Pheasants Forever would be the way to get in touch with us via phone or email.
Okay.
We're not doing a website, because we also, as we started, we did not know what kind of a response we would get, whether we'd be overwhelmed, whether we'd be searching for people. And unlike some of the veterans organizations that grant track chairs, we do not care about age. We do not care about gender, career. Financial is not a consideration for us. If we ever had so many applications that we had to really start picking and choosing, among those that qualified, we might look at financials. But at this point, we're simply asking people, what is the nature of your disability or physical challenges? And we want to know what you want to do with these chairs with bird dogs, and what is your outdoor passion brings you to do this? And our mission is very much about connecting these people for use, wing shooting and bird dog stuff.
Sure. Okay. Very cool. You just returned back from a little, I want to say vacation, but it was kind of like a training / vacation time, right? In Maine?
We go back and forth to Maine. Okay. We have a cabin there. We're back and forth. In fact, we're leaving in 2 days. We do a lot of our training up there with members of the, we're part of the Yankee chapter of NAVDA, and mm-hmm. a lot of our training is up in Maine. But right now, we're both training for the NAVDA Invitational in September. So we need to travel a lot to have our dogs work on different fields and in different waters.
Which dog are you running this year? What is your husband running?
I am a German short hair pointer person, and he is a German wire haired pointer person. Mm-hmm. So I have a 4-year-old female short hair from Merry Meeting Kennels, and he has a 2-year-old German wire hair pointer from Schwarzwald Kennels. And we've both been to the Invitational. We both have versatile champions from the past. But this is the second time we're both training at the same time, which is makes interesting times for a marriage when you're both training bird dogs for a major event and they're not necessarily excelling in the same areas. That's a polite way I'll put it.
Sure, sure. So are you guys helping each other out? Do you give each other advice or have you just come to, we just don't do that at this stage?
Well, we give each other advice, but it's offered very carefully.
Okay.
Like you have to wait till the person is done exploding with frustration before sure. you fuel the fire and then in a calmer moment. But we're doing all our training together because and you know, and I'm sure you can talk about it a little bit. There is so much involved for successful training. Everything from having the gunners and the birds and the fields or the water or the ducks or the, you know, whether it's a kayaking to put the duck out. I mean, there's so much involved. To train alone is difficult. We are training with other people all the time, but we're good training together. And, you know, in terms of helping and knowing what we want and what we need to do. And I'm sure you've had some experience doing, you know, with that scenario as well.
Oh, for sure. I'm curious though, since your husband has the wire hairs, you have the short hairs, you know, how, a lot of times, you know, people will come together and just have one breed, but you guys seem like you are really set on your separate breeds. Do you ever consider going the other way where it's all wire hairs, or would he consider going all short hairs, or what do you see that's advantageous about having that combo between the two of you?
I don't think there's anything particularly advantageous about it. But you know, some people are not breed loyal and they love trying all different kinds of breeds. Breed loyalty though, I think is much more common, and you just get into a breed and you love the characteristics of them. You know, I'm particularly, you know, my first bird dog was not, but my subsequent bird dogs have all been from Merry Meeting Kennels, and I just love their lines. I love, the package they've put together, the temperament package, the athleticism and conformation package, and, you know, really, you know, very, very carefully developed hunting instincts, that they've done in their lines. So, you know, I'm just really there. And I don't remember why when Terry got his first short hair, I think he was actually looking at Griffons as well. I think he just was intrigued by another breed and started with the wire hairs and just kind of fell in love with what's happening there. So I don't think we both love each other's dogs. Mm-hmm. And if I could not have a short hair, I would definitely have a wire hair, and I'm sure he would go the other way around. But it makes it more interesting, I think, to have the different breeds, which you certainly know as well.
Right. Right. Yeah. I think, you know, for us, it's this nice having a little bit, the two different breeds and having them complement each other, you know, on those cold days when there's ice on the water and, or it's light. I mean, the wire hairs just don't hesitate. They're great with just whatever conditions they have. They'll bust through that thick brush, and the Broncos just are like, no, that's not going to happen. If you want that pheasant deep in there late in the season and those cattails, you're just going to have to go get that yourself.
Yeah, and it's funny that you said that. That just did tweak one thought in my mind. I am not a big duck hunter at all. Mm-hmm. My duck hunting, I like to jump shoot. you know, ponds or inlets or something like that. I don't have the, like with turkey hunting, I do it, but I don't have the patience for it. And I for sure don't have patience for sitting in a duck blind or doing that 4 a.m. freezing cold. We live right by Lake Champlain, you know, get in the boat on the big broad lake in the dark with the ice. That does not work for me. And if that's one of the differences really that would come up because, like you said, the wire hairs, I mean, I know a lot of short hairs that do cold season duck hunting, but right. it would be pretty rough here in northern Vermont on the broad lake, and the wire hairs, they can take it. I mean, they've got the coats built for it.
Right. For sure. So you guys don't do any breeding yourselves. You always will just buy from the breeders that you know and trust.
Yeah, pretty much. We have no interest in breeding, although he's gone now, but one of Terry's wire hairs, we did breed him a couple times. And in fact, we still have one of his daughters. So as a stud dog, yes. But we're not really interested in breeding that much. There's so many good breeders out there that, you know, they don't need us in the mix and our lives are busy enough. And just knowing really what it takes. I have so much respect for breeders. And I think an awful lot of people don't realize the sleepless nights, the hours, the early puppy socialization, all the medical knowledge that you need, you know, I just don't think a lot of people realize what you breeders go through and need to do.
Yeah, it's intense. It definitely is. And I think, I mean, even after, I don't know how long we've been breeding since 2007. I'm always learning. There's always something new popping up and new ways to take advantage of how to socialize that, you know, the research is continuing and what we should do to have these happy, healthy puppies that have loads of instinct behind them and can just rock it. I think, you know, even in the NAVDA system, how much the dogs have improved, and you can probably testify to that, Nancy. Have you seen that firsthand? Because you've been involved for quite a while of just generally improvement of the breeds over the years.
Well, it's funny about that. I mean, I see a lot of dogs, and I think in some arenas, that is very, very true. The dogs are improving. I certainly know from the NAVDA testing system, you know, there's more and more dogs doing better and better and qualifying, you know, as utility dogs and going to the inventory. I mean, they're definitely, the dogs are better and better. I would say from my exposure, where I see the biggest change is in some of the breeds, which were kind of ruined for the show ring. Mm-hmm. And I'll you know, risk mayhem coming down on me, but I'm going to say some breeds like the Vizslas, the Weimaraners, some of these beautiful dogs where the, you know, and I'm long, you know, well before our time, we're talking back anywhere from the 1950s on, probably became popular in the show ring. So they bred them for their appearance and their beautiful coats and that sort of thing. And they lost their hunting instincts. And I think one of the things I see through NAVDA, where you have hunting breeders that are really looking at more than just, will this dog handle in a show ring and look, you know, look pretty. You have these breeders that really care about what's in the hunting package. And that's right. Where I think you're seeing the breeders just doing a really terrific job in sort of the restoration of some of these breeds that were really damaged by their popularity.
I agree. The breeds have been split quite a bit. You know, I think the few that have been able to stay together are kind of rare. And
we always say, you know, the worst thing that can happen to a good hunting breed is have it like win Westminster or something. You know?
Right.
Let the little teacup dogs have it. You know, we do not want to. We did have a short hair win at Westminster, and you don't want people watching these shows and saying, "Oh, I want to get one of those for my house pet," because then the breeders will start cranking out the breeds. I grew up with Dalmatians and saw that happen. And not in any issue of hunting, but seeing more and more dogs that had genetically created medical issues, because they were just, they got so popular that there were irresponsible breedings out there.
Right. And there are, to be fair, there are a lot of breeders that are working hard to keep it together, to have the proper structure and also that huntability. And I know I celebrate when you can see a advanced hunting title behind the dogs that are winning in the show ring, because I think that is pretty, pretty rare thing and something to be celebrated when they can do both successfully.
I agree very much. And yet the only thing I'd add to that is, yes, I shouldn't be rude to show breeders, because the conformation of the dog is very important. And as we know, conformation has a lot to do with the function of the dog as an athlete and a hunting dog. Mm-hmm. But what happened, I've seen it in some breeds, is that there are certain traits, and it might be coat color. It might be the desire for a blocky head. I'm going to risk again here offending people. A Chessie with a big blocky head. That serves no purpose practically. It became a popular look. And so the breeders would select for their breeds, their breedings, their pairings to enhance that. And when you're going to bump up something like that, you're going to lose something else in the genetic, formula that goes into it. So, we can't necessarily say, I won't generalize. I would not necessarily say that just because a dog is identified as having a superior appearance or conformation in the show ring, it does not necessarily have the characteristics that make it superior in the field.
And that's something I talk to people a lot with the German wire hair pointer. A lot of them are what you see in the show ring have 3 to 4 inches of coat hanging down like a skirt because it looks flashy and fancy. And those dogs win a lot because they can sculpt them to look very beautiful. but as well as I do, you put those dogs in the field where there's burrs and they're going to be miserable. They're going to be turning around and pulling burrs out of that coat. It's going to seal their eyelids shut because it's stuck from the top, from their eyebrows down to their muzzles. And it's just a miserable to hunt with, because I've done it. I've had it.
All our wire hairs have had tight coats. Mm-hmm. Have not had the super fluffy long hair coats. And
right.
I mean, in fact, when we got the last one, it was like, oh, please, please, give us a tight coat. And you can't always tell from birth when you're when they're little puppies, just how fluffy that coat's going to be. And yeah, I mean, the longer coats are, not only is your dog going to be miserable, but when you have to sit there with the comb and the scissors afterwards, you could be pretty miserable too.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. It's terrible. And we always tell people if they're 8 weeks old and they look like a wire hair where they have a full beard and coat, don't pick that one. Pick the one that just has a little bit of sprout, little bit of fringe on its ears, because that's going to be the one with the good coat when it gets older.
Yeah, exactly.
You want the coats that if they pick up a burr that they can turn right back around and it's, sweeps right off of them.
Yeah, so. And I appreciate that advantage with the short hairs.
Right. Yeah, you don't have to worry about that.
or I remember hunting a couple of years ago. We had some friends with Spinonis that came over. And oh my gosh, the amount of time afterwards, it was just like, well, get a comfortable chair and sit down because we're going to be working for a while. They just pick up so much debris.
Yeah. And a little tip for those listening that have the coated breeds, use some PAM spray. Spray that around in them before you go out hunting, because it definitely will make it easier afterwards to comb it out. Gross, because it's like greasy gross, but it saves you some time.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
That's the other tip that I picked up this summer, which is more for the short-haired dogs. If you live in a region that has a lot of ticks, and we have tons of ticks, using a lint roller the kind we use on our clothes just to get the dog hair off.
Yeah.
Those lint rollers. Now, if a tick is embedded, it won't pull it off. But a lot of times we come in and the ticks are still moving around on the dog. You see, it's like, oh, God, there's another one. You got to pull it off. And using a lint roller can often pull the ticks right off.
Interesting. I haven't heard that one before. Nancy, I wanted to talk to you today about an article you wrote for CoveyRise about the 5 stages of being a bird dog owner, which is relative to what we know about the 5 stages of being a hunter. Let's go through the first stage of being a hunter.
I would just want to back up for anybody who is not familiar with this, because it's become kind of a standard, the 5 stages of being a hunter. And just to give credit where credit was due, in the late 1970s, 2 professors at the University of Wisconsin in La Crosse, it was a Dr. Robert Jackson and Dr. Robert Norton. They did a study of a whole mess of hunters, like 1,000 or more hunters. And through interviews and all kinds of stuff, they identified 5 stages that most hunters go through, with the acknowledgement that sometimes you skip a set stage, sometimes you basically can be in 2 stages at once. But it seems to ring a lot of truth for a lot of hunters. And I, thinking about it one day, I realized that being a bird dog owner, we kind of go through the same stages, or a very parallel course. Okay, so the very first stage for hunters are called the shooting stage. And that's the beginner hunter, where you want to shoot at things. You're out there, you're just excited. You just want to do it. Just do it. And, you know, whether you hit, you miss, you know, it's just like, I want the opportunity to do it. And to me, the parallel of that, and I think this is where I first started talking about these servings as a parallel course, I called the first bird dog owner stage the discovery stage. And why that comes to my mind is my very first hunting dog, Harley, German Shorthair. I sort of trained him out of a book, but I was a new hunter too. In fact, like I said, I started hunting because of Harley. So he was around before I was even a hunter. And anything he did, I thought was spectacular. I mean, just the fact, my gosh, I actually have a dog and he's actually on point and there actually is a bird there. And that was it. I mean, anything we did, it was just like, let's go out there. You find birds. I didn't care what he did, except everything he did was good, because I basically didn't have the information to be disappointed by anything. It was all just this whole new Disney world for me. And so I kind of paralleled what they termed the shooting stage to what I call with a bird dog, your discovery stage, discovering this whole new thing that you're doing.
In that stage, are you just killing birds for them? Is that going to be that similar comparison where you're just out there having a good time? You're not so much worried about the training. You just are letting them go a little bit out of control.
No, I wouldn't say out of control, because just like if you take somebody out hunting for the first time, hopefully, you know, somebody doesn't just pick up a gun and walk into the woods and say, I'm going to go figure this out. Mm-hmm. You know, there's got to have been some shooting. You have to have a license. You have to have had a hunter safety course. So there have to have been preliminaries. You may not be a good shot, and you may need to be reminded about your gun safety. You need to be taught. I live in rough grouse and woodcock country. You may need to be taught what kind of habitat to look for these birds in. How are they going to behave? What's the best way to get them? So you have some beginnings, but you're still learning. And like with Harley, it wasn't just like, woo, let's go do it. I read a book or two, and, you know, we got a couple of quail. And so I was doing training, but a very preliminary training. But I guess to me, the biggest thing was where my mindset was at that point. And my mindset was I was happy with everything, and everything was a wonder for me. And so it was all good kind of thing.
So you didn't have a mentor when you started then. You learned from a book?
Yeah, pretty much. I did not have anybody teach me how to train a dog. I learned from a book. We had some people in the area that we kind of got some information from, it wasn't like taking your first dog and going to a NADDA clinic or anything. Okay. I used Ken Roebuck's book and read about it. And we had gone to a preserve. We knew somebody who was handling bird dogs. So we had some information coming in. Mm-hmm. But it was pretty simple at that point.
Okay. So what's the second stage?
So the second stage that the study had identified was called the limiting out stage. And that's when, you're scorekeeping. Then the limiting out stage, compared to just the, I want to shoot at anything and I don't care if I hit or miss. Now it's like, I want to get my limit. I want to connect on the bird. Now it's like, I understand what to do. And now your satisfaction is in doing it very successfully. To me, the parallel dog stage, I called it the proving stage, where now you're kind of at a mid-level training stage. And it's like, yeah, I want this dog to do everything right. I want to see the dog, the dog's got to find the bird. The pointing dog should point. Now, I may not be finished, but the basics should be there. And so I keep going back to first stage, you're happy at the end of the day, no matter what. The second stage, you're like, wow, we got some birds, but damn, if Harley hadn't, broken on his point, I would have been able in range to shoot that bird. So it's not, you're becoming a little bit more critical, but, and again, it's sort of a mid-level position, but you're proving that you and the dog know what to do. So your success in putting birds in the bag becomes more important.
Okay. So it's more of an intentional way of hunting.
Yes.
And what about, what's the next stage?
And so from there, the hunting stage is the trophy stage. So if you think of just in the hunter's term, the hunter's gone from, I just want to get out there and shoot at stuff, to I want to get my limit. I want to shoot my deer. I am allowed two turkeys, in the spring season. I need to get two. And that was in the second stage. In the third stage, I want a big tom and I want a long beard. Mm-hmm. In the third stage for the hunter, the bird hunter is like, filling the limit and wanting to make sure that you have the a beautiful pheasant with a huge long tail kind of thing. That's the hunter stage. To me, the parallel stage for the dogs is the finishing stage. Now, if I want my dog to, it's a sort of quality over quantity now. I still want all that success, but I want my dog to be finished. My dog better be steady. My dog better bring the bird back to me. My dog better not mess up my hunt. So there's a more of a perfection level when what they call the trophy stage, I'll call it the finishing or the finished stage. I want everything done right.
Right.
So it's not about just success every time, but success at a very high quality level.
At the trophy level.
Yeah.
So it is you as that hunter, then you're not shooting at birds. You're not shooting unless they are the trophy style bird that the dog has completely worked. Steady to wing shot. Okay.
Well, I don't know. It would depend on the individual. A lot of hunters who are in the finished stage or some even the proving stage, if the dog doesn't point it, they won't shoot it. If the flushing dog, bumps the birds or is too out of range or something, some might shoot, some might not. It depends what type of dog you have. I shouldn't just talk with reference to pointers. But in that case, that's a kind of individual. I know some hunters who, when they get to the trophy or finish stage, no, I am not going to shoot a young bird. I am not going to shoot a small bird. I know others that will shoot it. But at the end of the day, they will not have the satisfaction because their buddy comes in with the bigger grouse, with a more beautiful tail, that kind of thing.
If only we could tell so clearly of choosing the colors of the tails or the size of them before we shoot them.
I know somebody who claimed he only shot male ruffed grouse.
Wow.
He would wait to see the tail and only shoot it. And I am very skeptical.
Yeah.
Got some slow moving accommodating grouse in this neighborhood.
I mean, with the difficulty in sexing them anyways, with the very few characteristics in the tail, those two or three middle feathers there,
the broken band.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, there are other identifiers, but you can only really see them in hand. It's right. like trying to sex a woodcock by anything other than size. There are, you know, and beak length, but you really need the bird in hand. With the grouse, you know, this guy claimed he would see the tail to see if the band was broken or not. He maybe just had a lot better eyes than I do.
Mm-hmm. Impressive. How is there any research behind how long it takes someone to get to this stage, or what exactly it takes to get them to transition to this stage?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
From anything I read when I was doing the article or anything I've heard, that's a very individual thing. Some people, and it may have to do with how much you hunt and how immersed you are in it, that you might go through those stages quicker if you hunt more. Mm-hmm. It may deal with opportunity experience, and it may just deal with individual personality. I mean, some people also get stuck in some stages. I know men and women that get stuck in that trophy stage and their entire lives. It's all about, I have to fill my game bag and I have to get the biggest and the best. You know, and certainly it's true for some when we go into the bird dog stages parallel. That there are many people that are very content with staying in the proving stage and don't really want to put in the training time or don't have the opportunity or resources or time to finish a dog. I mean, I know tons of hunters that literally skip what I would call the finish stage because they don't care if their dogs are totally steady to wing shot and drop. And they don't care if their flushing dog learns to sit on the flush. These are very finished, fine end things. And they still have terrific hunts and they get lots of birds and they work as great teams. And they may jump right through over to the last stages and not go that trophy finished stage in the middle.
Okay. All right. What's the next stage?
So yeah,
what are we at? Four?
Next stage after trophy is called the method stage. And that's where instead of being more selective and about your the game you take, here it's strategy, you know, strategy rules, how you get it. And putting challenges in front of you, whether you're a deer hunter or a turkey hunter, and you go from gun to bow. Or, if you present yourself with greater challenges in finding habitat and, you know, saying, well, this place gets hunted a lot. I'm going to go find someplace new and really push it in a different way. For the bird dog owner, I consider the method stage sort of finessing the hunt and going beyond what we would, generally say, would be a finished dog, steady to wing shot and drop, retrieve to hand kind of thing. Here, we teach the steady dog to release on a flush. Here, you might be getting into hunting with other dogs and requiring the dogs to honor their brace mates and back each other's points. This may be a matter of, in a waterfowl dog, looking for the dog to make multiple blind retrieves, something that goes a step further that requires a different kind of training and strategy that's kind of a challenge in and of itself.
So this would be more typical of dogs, too, that may not have necessarily been taught it, but have sorted it out on themselves, knowing, whether it be specific landmarks for them, or they know if I get into this thicker cover over here, that's probably more likely to hold birds than going to that one. Is that something?
Yes, okay. Absolutely. A lot of part of it. And it's interesting because that's a real introduction to the final stage is when your dog has got it and understands it and does stuff themselves that they, you can't teach them. And the example I always give, and I have seen more than one dog, one of my dogs did it, but the first time we saw it was one of Terry's wire hairs. And it's the example I think I gave in the article, his dog Scrub. When we were pheasant hunting and we'd be working long cornfields, we would hunt on ranches or farms and we'd be looking long stretches of cover. He literally, you could not teach a dog to do this. He would point And then he would self-release, which in the beginning we're like, ah, bad dog. And then he'd run down and he'd pinch the bird. He'd literally run out of the cover or run to the side, run down, run around and come back towards us, which would trap the pheasant between us or force the pheasant to flush in range for us. And then I saw him do it. And my dog, Rimfire, would do it as well. And I saw both of them do that on woodcock, because woodcock will hold very, very tight. Or in past years, they'll run a little bit, but I have seen them point and then literally go make a big circle and come around facing. And so, you know, the bird would be kind of pinched between you. And there's no way you could teach a dog that.
Right. Right. That's why I love hunting over my husband's dog, I should say, Carmen. I just feel like every time you go out, and people that we've hunted with say, she's got such a great nose, but I'm like, it's not even that. She's just so clever. She's so keen on any type of cover we're in for those birds that she just knows exactly where to go. She's the only one that goes in there deep into the cattails, and she'll just stand on there and point. And, you know, it gets frustrating because we can't get in there.
Exactly.
You're just like, break, flush, do whatever it is. Stop pointing. I'm not going in there. So yeah, I like that stage. I like to see that stage in the dog for sure.
It's really something. And like I said, it kind of leads to the last stage in the hunting world. They call that the sportsman, and I have to make that. Okay. Sexist terminology. Let's call it the sporting stage. I would rather have it said, where it's the general experience. Usually these are veteran hunters. People have been hunting for quite a while. They bagged a lot of birds or ducks or deer or turkey or whatever it is. The hunter's been hunting a long time. So the taking the game is important, but not, it's about the experience in total. It's about taking the game. It's about their ability to do it, their understanding, their interaction with the landscape, with the wildlife, with their hunting partners. And that's the sporting stage, when the interest is more in the whole experience, the interest is in the big picture. Mm-hmm. For the bird dog owner, I called it the partnership stage. And that's where everything I just said is true for that. But the component, I mean, I don't know how many people I know that say, I wouldn't hunt if it worked for my dog. Mm-hmm. I have to go out today. I don't really feel like hunting, but my dog wants to go. And it's because it really has become a partnership. It's something. And, you know, I know a lot of people who have companion dogs and household dogs and family dogs, and those dogs are wonderful parts of their lives. But until you are working with a dog in a real partnership, an unspoken understanding of all kinds of stuff, there's nothing in the world that compares to it in my mind. And you don't get it from a puppy. You know, you only get it from a dog that you've put the miles on with the dog, for good and for bad, and the training and the everything else. And, you know, there's just little moments. And like, well, here's a moment that's stuck in my head forever. And there was about an inch of snow on the ground. I was hunting Rimfire. I could see the grouse tracks. And he's working the grouse tracks. I could see his nose go down. He's tracking the scent. And I could see which way the feet are going, and he was going in the wrong direction. Hmm. And he did it probably for about 20, 30 yards. And, I could see all the tracks, which was what was so cool. And all of a sudden he stopped and he turned and he looked at me, and he gave his expression was the human equivalent of like smacking yourself on the forehead and going, duh. And he gave me that look, turned around, zoomed right down the line, went past where he started, locked onto that that grouse in a beautiful point. And the grouse was kind of hunkered in under some brush and because it was snow, it was frosty. And Rimfire gave me this one close look back like, okay, I got it this time, and, the rest was history. But that stuck so much in my head because it's like, I mean, that dog and I were communicating on a level that was a lot more than just saying, want your dinner, and they run into the pantry kind of thing.
Right. Right. And there's what? More enjoyment, lack of disappointment. And even though you've gone through the stages of having that finessed dog work, are you probably more forgiving at this stage of if some of the dog work is a little iffy or has slipped that you're willing to forgive it.
Absolutely. I mean, not everybody. I mean, there is that argument. You know, there are people who will hit the last stage, but say, I still want, you know, I'll still correct my dog. I still don't want my dog breaking. I still don't want my dog, you know, dropping a bird, whatever it might be. That's an individual thing. I'm kind of like, hey, we hit this point. We're just out there to have fun together. I know you can do it. And, you know, unless a dog starts eating birds or busting points so I don't get shots. I mean, if a dog got really out of control, I would not accept that. But, you know, indiscretions, I don't mind. It's more about really, you know, going out, you know, and you know, for anybody who's listening who's not a rough grouse hunter, I mean, there are a lot of days up here in the, you know, Northeast, you do not find birds. But we go out there and we're working scent, or maybe I get a point on a turkey, or maybe, you know, we have to discuss whether or not we're going to do something about a rabbit. It's just, we're hunting together. I don't need other people with me. I know I got this dog and we know what we're doing. And we're having just a good time experiencing so many of the other facets of it together.
Mm-hmm. And do you find that that's going to be the favorite stage?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, we talk about it a lot. You know, when you're hunting with a young dog, I'm not going to say it's exhausting, but it's like you're watching them all the time. You have expectations. You've got hopes. You need to handle them. You have to handle them.
Right.
And I don't mean, you know, hacking on the dog, but it's like, you know, I have a problem with my younger dog right now, Prairie. I mean, she goes out of range. And so I have to whistle her and bring her back in. You can't go hunt. You may be getting sent, but I'm here. And, you know, that sort of thing. And, you know, if we're working in a more controlled environment, like we're hunting on a quail plantation, I'm handling her because I want her to have that expertise. And you take out one of these older dogs that you've had years with. I mean, sometimes you don't have to say a word. You don't have to toot a whistle. Start to finish, it's just happening, and it's so quiet and it's relaxing. And yeah, there's nothing like that.
Yeah, the cooperation, the bond, it makes for a much more enjoyable hunt.
Yeah, I mean, and that's really, you know, what the goal is. And, you know, but I would have to back off by saying, because as I don't know if you feel this way, I mean, those of us that are involved in NAVDA or NASTRA or other training testing organizations, we have all these levels of measurement that we go by to judge our dogs' tasks and behaviors and learning and training. And so that weighs into these different stages very much so. And I'm saying, you know, by the time you get to the last stage, it's all there or whatever. I still want to say that there are a lot of people that don't do that, that don't go, you know, that train their dogs some and they go out there and they train them to the level that they enjoy, that they're comfortable with, and they don't care if their dog breaks a point. They don't care if their dog, you know, drops a retrieve or something like that. And they can be right in that finished stage with just as much, you know, satisfaction and delight at the end of the day. So there's a lot of individuality to weigh in each one of these scenarios.
So you kind of touched on that then. So there is the ability to skip stages in this, where you're not going to have a finished dog, but that you can kind of skip to the just enjoying the yes. the partnership stage.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, they're definitely, I would say in particular, the very finished level stage, the equivalent of the method stage, the finishing level, the method stage, that's where it gets, I think it goes to very much individual, how much work you want to put in, what kind of hunting you do, that sort of thing.
And do you find that, I mean, I think of like our NAVDA judges, they're there volunteering, they're knowledgeable people, they've been through the motions themselves, and they're out there just doing this because they genuinely love watching dogs do what they're bred to do or trained to do, going through this, the whole system. And I mean, I think, would you agree that you find many of the NAVDA judges already being in that stage and they are judging because they just generally enjoy watching that those dogs work?
I'm not sure about that.
Okay.
That would sound to me like it makes sense, but I know a lot of very young NAVDA judges that I think when they go out there, they're still, I mean, they may, their dogs will be finished, but in terms of wanting to bag a limit, in terms of, you know, amping up the strategy and stuff like that, they're still very much, you know, still in their middle phases. To some extent, I have to say that I think the last stage is also how many years you've been hunting and, you know, which parallels to age. But I'm not saying, you know, there's a lot of men and women I know that are easily in their 60s or 70s and they still want to get their limit every single day, as I mentioned. But in terms of their, I'm not sure. I think the judges come in all shapes and forms, you know, and I know judges that will relax and be more in that sort of general appreciative stage. And I know other judges, because they're judges, they go out there, boy, their dogs better not mess up because they're afraid somebody, you know, if you're not a judge, you should have a perfect dog, which is necessarily true.
It's very true. Nancy, was there anything else that you wanted to add to that topic?
Only just to conclude by saying, you know, there's even with the stages of the hunters or the stages of the bird dog owners, it's a kind of fun exercise to look at. It's, you know, got, as I said, not everybody, it's not a black and white falling into this category, this block or that block kind of thing. And yet, I guess, well, the 2 points I would end with, one being that, you know, it's only a kind of mental exercise that you might want to go through yourself to think about what stage you're in, if you are the type of hunter that is sort of aware of yourself as what kind of a hunter you are or want to be. Otherwise, you know, it's just kind of a contemplation. The other point, though, is that, and I think I made this point closing the article too, what I discovered was when you're talking about working with one dog, my whole analogy here kind of works great. And in a big picture, it works great. But every time you get a puppy and you start all over again in your training, you go through all these stages. You kind of go through these in micro stages, because in the very beginning, that little puppy, like, oh, everything they do is so cute. Look, they point and point and point, you know, and then it's like, wow, the dog brought me a bird back. And then it's like, you know, you start moving up into the, you know, now you got to put some pressure on and amp up your training because the dog is dropping the bird, or, you know, and it's funny, you go through these stages in and of themselves over again with each puppy. And
right.
It matures into a dog.
Yeah, that's a good point. You're going through it as a hunter through those stages as your dog is going through the stages.
Yeah, and it's all fun. Whatever stage you're at, that's the
main point. It's got to be fun, right? Or else we wouldn't be doing it.
Which is why we often say, you know, I mean, the line, you know, when you're getting frustrated when your dog isn't doing something right in training, it's like, you know, and I'm doing this for fun. I mean, you know. Right. And then as soon as they do something right, it's just, you know, makes your day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Nancy, I like to ask all my guests on here what your favorite wild game recipe is, and you do a lot of rough grouse woodcock hunting there. Do you have anything specific that comes to mind?
I have one recipe that I use for just about everything when I know I can use it for everything and I don't have to think about it. I do all kinds of game cooking. But anything that's gamey, and I actually wouldn't do this with a rough grouse because they're a very mild, white, delicious tasting, but or maybe pheasant. But anything on the gamier side of ducks, woodcock, goose, gamier, like maybe some of the other grouse, I'm trying to think what a darker meat or a gamier bird. I do a version of a steak Diane recipe where you slice your meat thin, breast meat thin, and you pound it so it's nice and thin so it'll cook quickly. And you cook it in a pan with a stick of butter, Worcestershire, chives, you can shallots, salt and pepper. The idea is the butter and Worcestershire and chives are the key to it. And pounding it thin, it sears and cooks very, very quickly. And that, for anybody I know who doesn't like things that taste gamey, It's a great recipe. So, I mean, you can look at any steak Diane recipe and kind of work with that. As long as you pound the meat so it's a bit more tender than it might be, and it cooks very quickly, and that's just always good.
Perfect. Great tip there, because yeah, I'm not a fan of the gaminess, so I'm definitely going to give that a try. You'll have to send me the link when you get a chance. I can put it in the show notes.
I don't have any link. I can just send you.
You don't? Okay.
I kind of made it up. I mean, and I'm actually okay. I'm actually so lazy. If I don't have shallots or onions and garlic, I just use anything. And my chives, it can all just come out of the cabinet in a bottle that I can shake.
Perfect. I have it all ready to go.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Nancy. How can people find you and some of the work that you've done?
My website, which will be changing quite soon, but at this point, my website would be, if you just Google Annisfield Hunting Dog Photography or annisfieldphotography.com, and that's my website.
Perfect. And I will put that in the show notes as well. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Courtney. It was really fun talking, and thank you for asking me to be on the show.
Thanks for listening to this awesome episode with Nancy Annisfield. I'd love to know what you enjoyed most, were inspired to do, or learned from this episode. The guests I have on really enjoy hearing your feedback, so please share what you love and tag me in it. Your reviews and the 5-star ratings are what keep me motivated and coming back every Tuesday to share valuable content. Trust me, this is a labor of love. If you're interested in some swag and my favorite gear, be sure to check out thebirddogbabe.com. Most importantly, please support the sponsors of this podcast, the organizations that are working hard to conserve the birds you're chasing after, and the public lands in which you hunt.